You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the U.S. House of Representatives has taken up some big legislative steps around marijuana decriminalization. We'll talk about what bills have passed and where they're likely to go from here. Now, state health officials say as many as 700,000 healthcare workers and high-risk residents in Wisconsin could begin getting the COVID-19 vaccine by the end of the year. The rest of the state's 5.8 million people will likely have access to vaccines at the latest by fall of 2021. According to a recent nationwide Pew study, 60% said they would definitely or probably take the vaccine if it was available now. It's up from 50% back in September. 39% say they definitely or probably won't. But what if your employer required it? Turns out that here in the U.S., companies can fire you for refusing to comply, but there are exceptions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you get the COVID vaccine if your employer required it? Would you get it whether they did or not? Should companies be allowed to mandate vaccines? If you're the boss, are you planning on making your workers get it? If you're a customer of a space, would you want to know that the employees of that space had been vaccinated? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dorit Rice is a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. Her areas of expertise include administrative law, government law, healthcare law and policy, and vaccine law and policy. Dorit, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what does American law say about businesses' ability to say, hey, employees, you have to get a vaccine or you can't work here?
You captured it really well in your opening. Employers can generally impose health and safety rules on their employees, and asking employees to get the vaccine is a health and safety rule. Usually employers can require it, but there are four exceptions that may apply here. First, the vaccines will first be approved under an emergency use authorization, and it's unclear whether you can require, as an employer, a vaccine that's approved under an EUA. The law is simply unclear on that. Second, if you have a unionized workforce, you may have to negotiate with your union before you can impose a vaccine mandate. And that really depends on your collective bargaining agreement. Third, the Americans with Disabilities Act says that if an employee has a disability, which includes having a medical reason not to get the vaccine, an employer has to accommodate them unless it's a substantial burden, which is a very high bar. Accommodation doesn't mean letting the employee come to work unvaccinated like everyone else. It might mean, for example, requiring the employee to wear more PPE or isolating them from the rest of the employees, but you have to do something to allow them work with a disability. And finally, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 says that if an employee has a sincere religious objection to a rule, the employer has to accommodate them unless it's more than a minimal cost. The one thing I'd add is that requiring employees to get the vaccine doesn't mean you fire them if they don't. You may decide to use something less, for example, give an incentive to employees that get the vaccine, or give some kind of reward program.
Do we have a lot of precedent over employers requiring vaccines at the workplace, you know, previous to COVID-19 that we can work from?
We do. For example, there's a long tradition of healthcare providers requiring vaccines from their employees. A lot of hospitals require MMR, hepatitis B, and more recently, an increasing number of hospitals has required influenza vaccine. In another context, some restaurants require that their employees get hepatitis A vaccines, especially if there was a hepatitis A outbreak in the restaurant.
And have there been successful challenges to that under the Americans with Disabilities Act or other ways where employees have successfully, declined to take a vaccine in those instances?
There were a lot of challenges. Those that end with a decision by the court often lose. But there have been successes. For example, in a couple of cases, unions won against an employer saying you should have negotiated with us before imposing a mandate. In one case in New Jersey, a nurse that claims she had a philosophical objection to a vaccine won her case. She was dismissed, but she was suing for unemployment benefit, and she won her case. And there have been a couple of settlements. So it's rare, but there have been some successful cases in this.
Now, there are concerns with any vaccine of possible side effects. With vaccines that make it to the market, those tend to be very rare. But suppose an employee develops side effects, they can establish it's from the vaccine. If they are required to do that by their employer, are there liability issues there?
So the usual way to handling injuries on the job is through workers' compensation. And it's probably an injury from a vaccine required for work will also be covered under workers' compensation. So an employee should be covered under the same way as for other work injuries, and the employer would be liable potentially in the same way to workers' compensation.
We are talking about vaccines as they come on the market. There is some talk of employers maybe requiring employees to get a COVID-19 vaccine. We're talking to Dorit Rice from the University of California Hastings College of the Law, looking at the legal side of vaccine requirements at the workplace. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about this topic and your opinions. Do you want to see workplaces mandate getting a COVID-19 vaccine? Certain types of workplaces, would you want your employer to do this if you're an employer and are the one who might be setting this policy? What are you thinking about? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Dorit, we're in early days when it comes to these vaccines. They're not even, you know, they're not in our hands yet even. Are you getting the impression that a lot of businesses are considering this outside of healthcare, are considering requiring COVID-19 vaccines?
Not a lot, but I get the impression that at least some are. To remind you, the pandemic has upset the world for many of us and for many businesses. They've faced very real threats to their economic well-being and even survival. So some businesses are tempted to say a vaccine mandate will help me avoid future closures of this kind. As you're saying, it's early days. There's not a lot of vaccines going to be available. The first challenge is there won't be enough for everybody. Mm-hmm. And you can't mandate a vaccine that's not there. The other thing is, I just want to remind people that mandates by themselves aren't a substitute to getting people's trust and everything. It's one of your tools. It shouldn't be the only tool.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Cindy is with us in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I think this is a really dangerous precedent to set, because next thing you know, they'll be telling women they can't get contraceptives, or telling men they can't have vasectomies. You can't do this. You can't do that. I think employers have way too much power now and give them power over my body. I don't think so.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Dorit, Cindy worried about a slippery slope of letting employers make health decisions for employees.
It's a very reasonable concern. I will point out that employers already, in some contexts, set such requirements. As I mentioned, healthcare workers are required usually to get some vaccines. And for example, pilots have to undergo drug tests. So medical requirements in the workplace aren't that new.
Thanks a lot for that call, Cindy. On a wider note, Dorit, you wrote a piece about whether there should be national mandates for vaccines for a COVID-19 vaccine. The gist, correct me if I'm wrong, is no, there probably shouldn't, and no, there probably won't. What are your concerns with the idea of government mandates for a COVID-19 vaccine?
So if we're talking about federal mandates, the federal government has limited power. It probably doesn't have the power to require vaccines from throughout the nation. It may have power to require vaccines from some people. For example, it may be able to require that if you get a passport, you get a vaccine, or if you're traveling in interstate commerce, you get a vaccine, but it doesn't have unlimited power. The other part of it is mandates are a heavy tool, and not every place needs them. We probably don't need a national mandate to control COVID-19. We may at some point need some limited mandates to get to reduce loss of life, but the national mandate is a very heavy tool and may both create resistance and undermine trust.
And that speaks to a point you raised earlier, at whatever level, that trust building and communicating is probably a more important element than any kind of mandate, workplace, government, or anything.
That's exactly right. There's only so far you can enforce strong measures. A lot of the strong measures we have in states depend on high levels of compliance, and that depends on trust. using mandates as a first tool won't get you where you're going if there's too much resistance.
We're talking about whether employers can and should require workers to get the COVID-19 vaccine when it's available. Short answer is yes, they can, with some exceptions and asterisks there. Dorit Rice is a professor of law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law. I say the answer is yes, they can, not necessarily that they should. And that's where you come in, at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of employers requiring employees at certain businesses, lots of businesses, to get vaccines as a condition of employment, or on the other hand, to offer incentives to employees to get vaccines for COVID-19, again, when it's available? If you're an employer, would you do something like this? And do you have questions for our guest about how this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about vaccinations and our jobs. Companies around the country, some of them are thinking about whether to make the COVID-19 vaccine a requirement for employees, a condition of employment, or maybe, on the other hand, offering incentives for employees to get vaccinated. The law says an employer can make it a requirement, but there are some exceptions there. Dorit Rice is with us, professor of law at the University of California, Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you think of the idea of compulsory vaccinations for employees, whether you'd get a COVID shot if your boss says you'd have to, or if you're going to do it anyway, or if you'd require your employees to get it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on another caller now. Adam is with us in Lake Mills. Adam, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to state that I don't think it's appropriate that businesses, hospitals in particular, force a person to get certain vaccinations, you know, with this standing that you would lose your job if you don't, in particular since this COVID vaccine hasn't really been long-term, there hasn't been any long-term studies on it, I'd be concerned about that, and I would be opposed to my employer forcing me to do that.
Adam, thanks a lot for that call. Let's key in, Dorit, on that healthcare setting that Adam brought up in particular. Is there likely to be a stronger push to require vaccines in, you know, a hospital or a clinic or someplace where people are coming into contact and risking spreading a disease?
There may very well be, in part because, as you said, it's a place where there are vulnerable people at high risk if they get the disease, in part because, if you think about it, the other employees in the place may be put in risk by one who refuses the vaccine. And in part because there's a history, there's a tradition of requiring other vaccines in this setting. And people who go into healthcare are going into an area where, A, they're there to serve others, and that means accepting some limits on yourself, and B, they're already highly regulated. On the other hand, Adam is raising a very important point, which is this is a new vaccine, and we may be more hesitant to require a vaccine on which we have limited, if very promising, data. So we may be a lot more hesitant to mandate this kind of vaccine.
Adam, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We will go to Jamie now, calling from Beloit. Jamie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Henry, I don't know if it's so much as a question as it is just a scenario. With Wisconsin having so many so-called at-will employers, it's not, they technically wouldn't necessarily be making it mandatory, but it's an easy setup to go, you don't have to get the vaccine. However, you don't have to work here either.
Jamie, thanks a lot for that call. And Dorit, that distinction between at-will employment versus maybe that worker you mentioned earlier under a union contract that might play out differently in those scenarios.
I think that's exactly right. So Wisconsin is not unique in that. Most states in the United States have mostly at-will employment. And yes, that means that your employer can fire you relatively easily. And that can be for refusing to vaccinate and for other contexts.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Dorit Rice from the University of California Hastings College of the Law, looking at COVID-19 vaccines at the workplace, whether employers can require employees to get the vaccine, some of the legal sides of that. And you could join in still with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've got Cassie with us next, calling from Madison. Cassie, hi.
Yeah, I just, I kind of agree with, like, I left healthcare in part because of all the mandatory flu vaccines. And I don't think I would ever go back because of the flu vaccine. And especially now with COVID and the unknown repercussions, you know, if it did mandate the COVID vaccine, and it caused long-term side effects like infertility and other things, would the employers then be responsible for such things?
Cassie, thanks for that call. You were saying earlier, Dorit, probably no long-term liability from a potential side effect for a required vaccine. Do I have that right?
Not quite. Generally, you won't be able to take your employer to regular court, but you would be covered under workers' compensation, just as with other contacts. Just as in other injuries that are related to your work. So you would be covered in that scenario as an employee, probably more than outside the employment context.
And Cassie raised an interesting point. As a former healthcare worker, she says she left in part because of required flu vaccines. If we're losing, a small but significant number of healthcare workers who don't like mandatory vaccine policies, I guess you'd have to weigh the net hit on the healthcare system from that versus the benefit of requiring the vaccines. How do we balance that out?
That's a good question. And it becomes a question if you lose more than a very small portion. Hospitals generally require flu vaccines because they're weighing on one hand the possibilities that some workers will leave because they don't want flu vaccine, with the risks that patients will get flu in the hospitals and either die or at the least impose costs on the hospital. The hospitals that require flu vaccine conclude that the other risk, the risk of patients dying, getting seriously ill, or having costs related to influenza acquired in the hospital are higher than the risk of losing a significant number of the workforce. If they want to adopt COVID vaccine mandates, they'll have to consider, is it going to be different for COVID? And again, here we get to the point that mandates are not a substitute to education. If a high percentage of your workforce doesn't want to get to the vaccine, the mandate alone probably won't get you very far.
Thanks for that call. Tom joins us next in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
Hi. I was hoping you could comment on what the drivers are for these organizations to mandate vaccines in general. Is it specifically from for example, a liability perspective, in that the employer does not want a wrongful death lawsuit on their hands? Or is it more from a customer standpoint where, again, the organization does not want to be sued for, oh, I got COVID from my school district or employer X? What are the drivers for these organizations to mandate the vaccinations? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Interesting point, Tom. Thanks for that call. Yeah, so how much of this could be, I own this business, I don't want people to get COVID at my business, employers or customers, and then sue me for that, Dorit?
It's probably not so much about being sued. It would be hard to sue an employer for a COVID infection. Among other things, it would probably be hard to narrow the source of the infection to one specific workplace. However, a business can have reputation gains from this kind of requirement. They can say, I'm safer than other business. Look, all my workforce is vaccinated. And they could also say, you don't need to close me. I'm not going to have a COVID outbreak because my workforce is vaccinated. I think those two are stronger drivers than the risk of a lawsuit.
Thanks for that question. Sierra joins us now in Wautoma. Sierra, hello.
Hi there. I'm a registered nurse currently, and there are options for people who want to opt out of the flu vaccine by wearing a surgical mask at all times during flu season. Is that going to be an option for people who want to opt out of the COVID vaccine?
Oh, that is an option. Interesting, Dorit. Do you see employers maybe tackling things that way?
That is why it's important to remember that the mandates doesn't automatically mean workers that don't comply will be fired. There's a whole range of in-between options. Mm-hmm. For example, an employer can say, I want everybody to get the vaccine. If you don't want to get the vaccine, you need to sign a statement saying why you don't want to get it. Or, as was suggested, you need to wear more PPEs than everybody else. There's a whole range of options between saying get the vaccine or be fired and saying I'm not going to require it in any way, shape, and form. Having a extra PPE, maybe a mask, maybe even something more, may be an in-between options for employers that want more vaccinated people but aren't comfortable firing people who don't want to get the vaccine.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Reggie is with us in Appleton. Reggie, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to say that as a truck driver who deals a lot with manufacturing industries, I think it should be mandatory that we get vaccinated because of the loss of business.
Reggie, shortened to the point. Reggie, worried about the economic impact of people aren't getting vaccines, seeing that as a motivation for employers to require it, Dorit.
And I think he's right. That's one reason that many employers are considering it. The other consideration from a point of view of someone like Reggie is people who are essential workers are in touch with a lot more people than most of us, and they're at higher risk if they're not, if their coworkers are not vaccinated, or if people they come across aren't vaccinated, they might get the disease.
Thanks a lot for that call, and Dorit, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Dorit Rice is a professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of the Law. We talked to her about vaccination law, including whether employers can require employees to get vaccines. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, the U.S. House passed a law that would decriminalize marijuana at the federal level, though it's not expected to pass the Senate. Our guest looks at the latest developments, and you could join in with your thoughts. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 2020 has put a strain on a lot of relationships. A couples counselor joins the show with advice on how to work through the rough patches and how to know when it's time to call it quits. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, while recreational marijuana is now legal in more than a dozen states, it's still illegal at the federal level. Last week, the House of Representatives passed a bill that would decriminalize the drug nationally. The bill is not expected to go anywhere in the Senate, but it's still considered a big moment in the story of marijuana in the country and a sign of major change in public perception of the drug. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think marijuana should be legalized or at least decriminalized at the national level? Why or why not? Do you think Wisconsin should join the states legalizing the drug? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. John Hudak is deputy director of the Center for Effective Public Management and a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
Well, let's put this bill in some context. Has there ever been anything like this passing either chamber of the U.S. Congress?
Absolutely not. This was a historic legislative action by the U.S. House. There has only been one other bill related to cannabis reform, a freestanding bill related to cannabis reform that has ever passed a Chamber of Commerce. That was the Marijuana Banking Act that passed in late 2019. But this is a much more comprehensive piece of legislation.
And tell us what it does.
So it does a lot. The bill is called the Marijuana Opportunity Reinvestment and Expungement Act. And what it does first is it removes cannabis from the federal schedules, which essentially removes all criminal penalties related to cannabis at the federal level in the United States. It doesn't necessarily set up a legalization system in the way that you've seen states, your neighboring state of Illinois, states like Nevada, Colorado, and others do, but it removes all of those federal penalties. It also has provisions that work with states that have already set up legal systems or will set up legal systems in the future to make sure that things like packaging and labeling and testing is standardized or at least meets certain provisions that are set forth by the federal government. It taxes cannabis with a federal tax of 5%, at least to start. And that tax revenue then is used to reinvest in communities that have been hit hardest by the drug war. And finally, it expunges all low-level nonviolent cannabis crimes at the federal level. That is retroactive and for anyone currently facing those charges.
And the state of affairs now, we have states, as we know, that have legalized medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, and that's legal at the state level, but not at the federal level. Technically, the federal government could try to enforce marijuana laws in those states. It's, in effect, chosen not to under the Obama and Trump administrations. Is that basically where we are right now?
That's absolutely right. So medical and adult use cannabis dispensaries across the nation are operating legally in their states, but each of them is violating federal law very explicitly. And you said it right. The federal government could go into states and start shutting down these systems and arresting people, seizing assets, et cetera. But they have opted not to. And part of the reason why is that the system has just gotten so large. There are now 15 states, plus the District of Columbia, that have legalized cannabis for adult use, and nearly 40 states with full-fledged medical cannabis systems. And so the ability of the feds to shut this down is limited, and under the Constitution, the feds cannot compel a state government to enforce federal law. And so, in a sense, they're on their own, and the resources just aren't there to do that.
Now, this is all the U.S. House controlled by Democrats, gotten a little bit of Republican support and a little bit of Democratic opposition in the vote here. But that brings us to the Senate, which nobody, I think, John, expects to pass this.
Yeah, no one who's thinking seriously or is a serious observer of D.C. politics expects the Senate to even take this legislation up. I think right now it's hard to see the MORE Act, even if it were to come up, getting to 50 votes in the Senate, it would also, of course, have to get 60 votes to beat a filibuster. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is not an individual particularly in favor of cannabis reform, and because of that, the MORE Act is dead. And of course, with the Congress wrapping up at the end of the year, even if MORE were to move forward next year, it would require the House to take it up and pass it again.
That said, though, the fact that this is voted on in the House, I mean, it wasn't that long ago where if you were a politician and you said, yeah, marijuana legalization in any form, you would immediately define yourself as a fringe politician, right? This is not something people would stick their necks out for.
Yeah, you were a fringe politician. You were probably coming from a very liberal city. Earl Blumenauer is someone who has been advocating for cannabis reform for almost 50 years in the Oregon legislature and the U.S. House. And he represents Portland. That's the type of community that you would expect someone to be coming from if they were supporting this, 15 or 20 years ago. But now it's mainstream. If we look just at election night, four states passed adult use cannabis or recreational cannabis programs. They are San Diego, Montana, Arizona, and New Jersey. States that are very different from one another. And I think it shows the diversity, not just with regard to what is happening at the state level, but the diversity in the coalition of people supporting cannabis reform nationwide.
You said San Diego, South Dakota. Was that the other state?
Oh, sorry, South Dakota. My mind has been on San Diego today. They just swore in a new mayor today in a sort of historic moment. So my mind was on San Diego, but you're
same
right.
Same initials.
South Dakota.
John Hudak is with us from the Brookings Institution. We're looking at marijuana decriminalization, a bill passed the U.S. House that would do that at the federal level, not expected, as we heard, to pass the Senate. You could join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Leaf is with us in Eau Claire. Leaf, hi.
Hi. So My question was if you think there are any cons to the decriminalization or legalization to marijuana.
John, downsides.
Thanks for that, Leif. You know, obviously with any area of public policy, there are positives and benefits. And, you know, we need to think about how to minimize the risks that exist with any of the public policy changes that we enact. And with cannabis use, with cannabis legalization, we have to worry about use in certain contexts. Who's using? Are youth using? Are individuals who are prone to or have experienced cannabis use disorder or dependence, addiction, are they using in higher rates or in heavy amounts? So guarding against those types of things, making sure that the public is informed about the law, about the products, about what the product will do to you, when it's okay and responsible to use and when it's not, for instance, when driving or operating heavy machinery, caring for children, et cetera. And so, yeah, there are downsides, but there's a lot of downsides to prohibition as well. You know, we have hundreds of thousands of individuals, disproportionately Black and Brown Americans, who are locked up every year because of cannabis-related offenses. And so, you know, I think most Americans recognize that all public policy choices have some risks to them. Most Americans, the supermajority of Americans, have decided that prohibition has failed public policy, and trying something different with safeguards in place is probably the better step forward.
Thanks for that call. We had a caller from southern Wisconsin who couldn't stay on the line who wanted to say his wife has Alzheimer's, so he drives to Illinois to get her marijuana. Not legal in Wisconsin, legal in Illinois. He says he doesn't feel comfortable doing it, but it seems to be the only thing that brings her some relief. Can you talk about the interstate issues this is raising, John, when you've got states like Wisconsin with no legalization, all of our neighbors having at least medical, mostly with recreational?
Yeah, this is something that happens in a lot of parts of the country, and the caller's experience is not a unique one. Living in a state where prohibition is in place and driving to a state where you can get the substance either for medical relief or for personal use, and crossing that state line into a state where it's illegal. It's also obviously illegal to cross state lines with it as well. It's actually one of the areas that the Department of Justice considers problematic, even in this non-enforcement scenario that they've set up. But the reality is that, like your caller, there are a lot of Americans who argue that they or family members get medical relief from the use of cannabis. And a lot of people are willing to go to the ends of the earth if it's going to help a loved one or help themselves. And I think that's a pretty common situation in the United States with this patchwork system right now.
Let's bring on another caller. Kathy is with us in Oconomowoc. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. Not that I use or anything like that, but I know a lot of people that do. And I think for just, you know, home use and stuff, I think it'd be fine to be able to get it. It would free up the court systems. I think it would free up a lot of police time. And also, but I think they should increase the tax on it. If they can afford to smoke, then they need to pay a little more to cover people that don't handle it well. So,
Kathy, thanks a lot for that call. I think you mentioned 5% was what the House had passed, a 5% federal tax, in addition to whatever, I guess, state and local governments would do. Can you talk about that, John, and then what you said were the benefits potentially for courts and police time?
That's right. The MORE Act puts in place a 5% federal tax, which would lay on top of the existing state and local taxes. Now, I think your point is an important one, Kathy, that if users are going to access cannabis, then that tax revenue can be used in important ways, to keep roads safe, to assist with mental health and addiction, have better education programs, et cetera. And that's all important. But it is also important to recognize that there are some competing issues around the tax issue itself. And that is, one of the goals of legalization in the states is to help displace or get rid of the black market. People don't think of it this way, but marijuana users are rational actors. They think about price when they consider where and under what circumstances they're going to purchase. And so if you raise taxes too high, it's going to make potential customers more likely to stick with the black market if it's cheaper, particularly if it's quite a bit cheaper. And so that balance needs to be had between getting the amount of tax revenue that's necessary to meet the goals that you want, while also recognizing that it is a consumer market where consumers are going to be making choices, and part of that choice is based on price.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to John Hudak from the Brookings Institution, author of the book Marijuana, A Short History, talking about moves at the federal level to decriminalize the drug. The U.S. House passed a bill that would do that. U.S. Senate, probably not gonna. The goal to help communities that have been disproportionately affected by enforcement of existing laws. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government decriminalize marijuana? Should Wisconsin do something like that? Medical, recreational, all or none? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about marijuana legislation in the U.S. House. John Hudak is with us from the Brookings Institution. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about what's going on and your opinions about what should be going on. Jonathan joins us next in Janesville. Jonathan, hi.
Hey.
Hi, go ahead, Jonathan.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was just bringing up, I wanted to shed some positivity instead of anything negative towards either on a federal level or a local level towards marijuana. I think it could be extremely beneficial in doing, if you can make the right plans and tax everything correctly, I think you could put it back into the schools. You can put it back into small local businesses that are struggling. I just think, the positives definitely outweigh the negatives in a situation like this.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for that call. Talk a little bit about the economics and potential economic impact here, John.
I think, Jonathan sounds like what a lot of voters sound like in states that are considering legalization or that have legalized, and they're really focused on tax revenue. It's important to put forward a caveat that the tax revenue is significant from cannabis programs, but it's not something that's necessarily going to balance a state's budget or, especially in the environment that we're in, get a state out of the type of budget holes that have been created by the pandemic and the recession. But it is money that the state would not be accessing otherwise if they hadn't legalized. But the economic impact of legalization goes far further than the tax revenue base that it creates. It also creates above ground economic activity. And so you're taxing wages. You are seeing an entire market pop up, but then a market pop up around the cannabis market that serves it, whether it's the construction of dispensaries or grow operations, whether it's electricians or others, accountants, lawyers, et cetera. And so there is a ripple effect into the economy beyond just the market itself, that I think we know from experience, at least, can have fairly significant positive effects for a state and a locality.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Jen with us in Waukesha. Jen, hi.
Hello. Your caller was just kind of touching on this with the economic benefits, but he's stated multiple times that the measure to decriminalize has passed the House of Representatives, but is not expected to pass in the Senate. And I'm kind of wondering if there's any idea as to why that seems to be the way that the Senate is leaning, and especially in light of the fact that there are states that have decriminalized and you can see that there are definitely economical and tax benefits.
Thanks for the call. John, what are the reasons for U.S. senators and others opposing decriminalization?
Jen, it's a great question. There are a lot of senators, some from mostly Republicans, but some Democrats too, who have either outright opposed cannabis reform or have suggested that they're not comfortable with it. And that is a question that I get asked a lot. Why is it that an issue that is so popular, 68% of Americans in the United States support full-scale legalization at the national level, and why then is there this disconnect between the public and their elected officials on this? And part of the reason is a generational one. There are a lot of older Americans who represent us in the United States Congress, especially the United States Senate, and older Americans are disproportionately less likely to support cannabis reform than younger Americans are. That's true in the public, and it's true in the U.S. Senate as well. At the same time, voters are not really holding elected officials to account over their views on cannabis. At least we're not really seeing that yet. There are 50 issues in, you know, ahead of the marijuana in the line of issues that voters care about and that they're going to hold their elected officials accountable on. And so until there's more generational change in the Congress and until there is a greater respect for this issue by elected officials, we're going to see that disconnect endure.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Dan now in La Crosse. Dan, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What
so
you want to bring?
I wanted to say that I'm not against. I'm not against decriminalization, but I would have concerns. I don't quite think we're ready for it yet as a society. We don't have controls in place to keep it from getting into hands of children or younger people. And then the other thing, most importantly, is, you know, we don't have ways of testing for it. So we've had huge issues with, you know, drunk driving and people driving under the influence of alcohol. We don't have any breathalyzer test or any way of testing for the use of marijuana, not only while you're driving, but, you know, a lot of employers have implemented drug testing for the safety of personnel and for the safety of the workers.
Sure. Dan, we don't have much time, but I want to throw that to John. John, how have the states that have legalized recreational marijuana dealt with those important issues that Dan brought up?
You know, there are systems in place within the states to guard against this. The first and most important one, particularly with the issue of youth use, is that dispensaries require identification for a purchase in a way that drug dealers don't. Now, that doesn't create a perfect system. You could have proxy buyers where someone over the age of 21 goes in and purchases for someone younger, and there's really no way to guard against that. But it's important to note that those behaviors are already happening now under a system of prohibition. What I like to say is that cannabis legalization is not going to bring cannabis to communities. Cannabis already exists in every community in the United States. It's just a matter of being able to manage it differently with a regulated system. With regard to Dan's point about workplace testing and workplace safety, every state that has legalized cannabis has allowed businesses to be able to maintain drug-free environments. So in the same way, if you are coming into work drunk, you can be fired for that. And if they are doing drug testing and you test positive for cannabis, employers have the option to use that as a fireable offense. Now, they're not required to, but they can maintain that. And so I think there's a concern in the lead up to legalization initiatives or legislative debates about what's going to happen to businesses. The reality is that business practice around drug testing doesn't change at all post-legalization.
Thanks for that call. In our last few moments, John, do you see a road from here to actual federal decriminalization with both chambers of commerce signing off or chambers of Congress signing off on it?
I think it's really an eventuality. The current Senate and really the next Senate is not going to be one where we're seeing cannabis reform happening. But, you know, the writing is on the wall. As I said earlier, generational change is a really serious force. We're seeing this effort led largely by Democrats, but it is a bipartisan issue, particularly in the public. And while we might not see legalization happen in the next year or two, we will certainly see it happen in sometime in the near future because the stars are aligning. And once individuals in key leadership positions in the Congress age out, choose to retire, and they're replaced by people who are more focused on where the mainstream view on this issue is, we're going to see some real progress happen.
John, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Hudak is Deputy Director of the Center for Effective Public Management and Senior Fellow in Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. He's the author of the book Marijuana, A Short History. We talked to him today about the significance of the House passing a national marijuana legalization bill. Again, probably won't get passed in the Senate. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 6, have you heard a good book lately? Kate and her guests take a tour of the world of audiobooks, and you could share your recommendations. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll take a look at how the incoming Biden administration may approach immigration issues, including hundreds of thousands of so-called Dreamers in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Wisconsin Public Radio is listener-supported. What does that mean? It means that listeners make up the single largest piece of our budget. It means that WPR programming simply wouldn't be the same without listener donations. If you enjoy WPR programs but have never donated, change that today. Make a difference. Make a donation at WPR.org. Thank you.